Hi everyone, so welcome to the latest episode of the Maps podcast. This is actually episode 23, I believe it is. And it's actually now about eight months since the last episode was recorded. You'll see in the podcast in a minute. I mentioned that later I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell you why we've not recorded and whatnot like that. And anyway, I never got around to it. We actually ran out of time because Lauren, our special guest, is so full of knowledge that we actually didn't even finish all the things we wanted to talk about. So the podcast is brilliant. Get onto it. Is absolute loads of information. You'll love it. And I'm sure you'll love Lauren in her unique way of describing things and a little trick that she plays on me as well. So, 8 months now. The reason is simple why I've not recorded any podcasts. We all know what's been going on, with lockdowns and pandemics and all that kind of stuff. And I do this podcast because I enjoy it. I do it because I want to provide information. But equally, it takes a bit of time in terms of recording, getting it edited, all that kind of stuff. So I just made the decision to pause for a little while I focused on my business, while I focused on the people that I help and the people that I serve every day, and while I focused on my family and then finally on myself as well. So it was absolutely a conscious decision. That said, it's great to be back. I'm going to be bringing more guests to you from a wide variety of places, talking about a wide variety of things. I'll probably do it in bursts where I release sort of 4 or 5 podcasts at any one time and then take a little break, but we'll see how it goes. Anyway, enjoy this podcast. It's absolutely brilliant and I'll see you soon. Take it easy. Okay, guys, welcome to the latest episode of the Maps podcast. It's good to be back. It's been a while. We'll get into that in a bit in terms of why. I've not recorded anything for a while. I hope you are well. And as always, in terms of the format of these talks and podcasts, I'm going to continue with the format of having a special guest. So I'm going to introduce this episode's special guest, which is Lauren Downes. Hi, Lauren. How are you doing?
Hi, Eric. I'm okay. Thank you.
So, I mean, what I will say, Lauren, before we go any further for our listeners is 2 things. First and foremost, you're a cognitive behavioural therapist. That's correct.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the second thing, the most important thing, our listeners might need to tune in a little bit because, like me, you're from Manchester and you're Dead Man Communion, aren't you?
Yeah. And it'll probably seep out throughout this conversation.
Yeah. So this is going to be like the
and I our kid.
Yeah. Like the Gallagher brothers talking to one another, isn't it?
There we go.
Yeah.
I'll be Liam.
Oh, wow. Okay, thanks. I'll be the older one.
Thank you.
So, Lauren, just... we've got a specific subject today, which we'll get into and things that, are going to flow and all that kind of stuff. And we might go off on a tangent and wherever we end up, we end up. But just obviously in terms of your role.
Yeah.
Without giving, we're aware there's a level of confidentiality and whatnot like that. But just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into being a cognitive behavioral therapist. And just give us a little bit of background about you.
So I started off and I wanted to work within prisons with offenders. So I did a degree and a master's in forensic psychology. And then when I worked in a medium secure hospital, so with people that had committed quite high level crime, I realised that's not what I wanted to do because it was too much risk management. And I actually wanted to help people and get people to maybe change their way of thinking and their way of behaving. So then I started working and did some training to treat children. I did some training to treat adults, low-level therapy. And then I went to work with children for a little bit because I thought that working with children and adolescents might sort of set the groundwork a bit earlier and help change a little bit sooner. And then I trained up to be a CBT therapist within within children and adolescents, and then moved back over to adults. So at the moment I work with over 16s, up to any age that have anxiety disorders. So any of the anxiety disorders, so social anxiety, health anxiety, generalized anxiety, which is worry, post-traumatic stress disorder, and I also work with depression as well. So lots of different things.
I mean, we'll get to that in a second, but am I right in saying then, I don't know, it was your former career, you worked in prisons, was that?
Well, I worked in a medium secure hospital. So if somebody has committed a crime, mm-hmm. and they have a diagnosed severe and enduring mental illness, they'll get sent to a secure psychiatric hospital. So an example of a high secure might be like Ashworth in Liverpool, where Ian Brady was, somewhere like that. And I worked in a medium secure, so the one down from that. So it's a hospital, but there's a lot of risk management of helping people with their mental health, but also managing the risk that they might pose to other people or themselves. Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, I bet you know, obviously, as I said at the start, there's certain things you can talk about, certain things you can't talk about, but tough gig that, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, very much so. Because also, in those lines of work, you're working with perpetrators, whereas now, I would work more with the victims of the crime, so of both sides of it, really. But yeah, there's probably not much that I've not seen or heard. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, you know, perpetrators, just for those who, you know, you maybe haven't heard that before, it's people who commit the crimes, right?
Yeah. So working with people that have been on that side of it, that have committed the crimes, but now I work if I'm doing, say, a piece of trauma focused therapy, I'll work with the other side of it, so the people who've been the victim of those crimes. Yeah.
Amazing. So you know, you went trained up working with kids.
Yeah.
Now working with adults, right?
Yeah, came back to adults. I loved working with children, but just career wise, I had to come back with adults. But love both. There's upsides to both. Yeah. Interesting though, working with young ones, and you feel like you can really get in there with the young ones because they're still like sponges and they're really malleable and they take everything in. That comes with its difficulties as well, because if you're working with teenagers or children, you are working with a full system. You're working with parents, step parents, any caregivers. You're working with school. Whereas when you're working with adults, although you're still working with a system, not so much so. You're working with them individually.
You mentioned it. You touched on it a second ago, like. I think it's big now, isn't it? And that's why we've been talking about doing, like, speaking and talking and recording and all that. How long have we been threatening to do this for now? It's got to be well over a year, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was before lockdown started. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, obviously, like, I think you touched on mental health and depression and all that, and we're going to get into it, aren't we, in a specific aspect of it, and then, you know, wherever we go from there. But am I right in saying that, you know, because of lockdown now, and I know these stats being thrown around, but mental health is, you know, it's a problem, right?
Yeah, definitely. So I would say that there's been a significant increase in the severity and the frequency of people coming through with common mental health problems. So any of the anxiety disorders, there's lots of them, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think that one of the reasons for that is that we all have ways of coping, whether they be unhelpful ways of coping or helpful ways of coping. Mm-hmm. We've all developed them as we've lived our lives. And what's happened is lockdown has stripped us of those coping mechanisms. So people aren't able to go to work and get that reward from being in work and being surrounded by people and being distracted. People aren't able to use gyms, people aren't able to do things that they find enjoyable or self-soothing. And people are in their heads a lot more. So we're seeing a lot more trauma coming through at the moment. And this can be historical trauma of things that have happened to people maybe 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that they've managed in some way to manage themselves. But now, because they've been stripped of those helpful coping mechanisms, it's all coming to the surface. So these people are really, really struggling to cope with things because they are in their heads so much, because we've got so much more time to be in our heads. So yeah, I'd say it's worsened pretty significantly. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm muting myself. I've got a little bit of background noise there while I'm trying to listen to you as well. And something that I picked up on there, and you know, you mentioned anxiety, you mentioned depression, and but it was the PTSD. Now, I first came across the term PTSD because I've got friends who served in the military. Is it fair to say that, like, I think PTSD, people assume that that was for soldiers, or maybe that was a presumption?
No, that is completely what people think. So if I said to you that I wouldn't say too much for confidentiality purposes, but let's just say that I speak to 22 people a week. I would say that maybe 10 to 15 of those contacts have got PTSD. Mm-hmm. And I'm not working with anybody that has PTSD from war. So people always assume, when you say this sounds like post-traumatic stress disorder, the amount of times people say, is that not just with soldiers? Yeah. Or people that have been in the military? And PTSD can come from anything that is traumatic. So it could be, and it doesn't have to be wider world viewed as traumatic. It's just that the way that your brain has made sense of it is that it's felt traumatic and it's been traumatic for you. So we could have it could even be something like when you were little, the way you were parented. It could be verbal things that have been said to you over time. It could be accidents. It could be the ones that we think of as being a bit more obvious. So any forms of abuse, so psychological, sexual violence, physical harm. It's anything that our brain struggles to process and is highly impacted by, that then we get the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. But it's not just military.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm obviously working as a coach and a performance coach, and I talk about, you know, when I worked in my background as, you know, as a physical trainer, a fitness trainer, it's kind of, you know, as life, let's say, has progressed and we kind of eat a bit more fast food and a bit more junk food. And alongside that, people, I think, you know, the stats don't actually lend to this, but I think that more people exercise now than they did 20, 30 years ago. Maybe the point I'm saying is that maybe they've got a set of tools that, you know, they kind of, you know, eat a bit too much, drink a bit too much, whatever, but they try and combat it with a set of tools or with a set of skills. And I think, you know, our brain, if we look at it like a muscle, like a bicep, we don't train, that's the poor way of describing it, but we don't have the tools or try and even get the tools to cope with the job, do we, of what life brings to the table now, you know?
Yeah, we all have it within us to use the right tools. But a good example that I give to people is that if somebody came along and said to me, okay, I'm feeling really anxious or really traumatized, or I'm feeling really depressed, or they just were generally feeling pretty shit. And they said to me, right, I need help. And I said to them, okay, I've got two options for you. I can give you a red pill, and the red pill will get rid of your feelings straight away. These horrible feelings that you're having, it will get rid of them straight away, but the red pill will only last maybe an hour, couple of hours, maximum of a day. You're going to have to keep popping the red pill. I'm going to give you a big bag of these red pills, and you can carry them around with you, but they're dead heavy. And when the red pills run out, you're going to have to come back and order some more. But you can just pop them whenever you want. Gets rid of the feeling straight away. Or I can offer you one single blue pill. Now, a single blue pill, I can't 100% promise you that it's going to work. And if it does, it may take a few months. But if the blue pill does work, you're never going to have to take another blue pill again, or you might have to come back for a top-up blue pill in a year or in 10 years. But the blue pill is the long-term relief. It's the coping mechanism that's long-term. When we're in a state of being rational and we're feeling okay and we're not in a heightened state of an emotion, a negative emotion, then we would all say, go with the blue pill, try the blue pill. But anybody who is in a state of high levels of distress or is feeling very depressed or very anxious or very traumatized, most people are going to take the red pill because as human beings, we want a short-term relief from that feeling. And we all have red pills, all of us, even the ones that pretend that they've not and look like they've got their act together. We've all got red pills that we engage in. Because as humans, we've learned that they bring us some relief. They help us feel a certain way. And like you said there about people might eat too much, drink too much. People might also, as for their red pills, they might, it might be drug taking. It might be loads of alcohol. It might be avoiding certain situations. It might be, a red pill might be, if you see someone you vaguely know walking down the street and you don't know whether it's going to be an awkward conversation, getting your phone out and pretending you've not seen them. But we all have these coping mechanisms.
Yeah, I was just going to say a coping mechanism, yeah.
We all have them. We all have them in our own ways. We, you know, we've all got them. But the trick is to realise that the red pills, they give us short-term relief, but in the long run, they're not helpful. And actually, it's about trying the blue pill. But people find their own blue pills as they go through life. But at the moment, with lockdown, the blue pills have been stripped. So people will be resorting to the red pills.
Yeah. What I always say in my coaching program is short-term pleasure equals long-term pain.
Definitely.
When repeated often enough. Just something I wanted to pick up on there, and I just put myself a little marker down there just to remind me. Before we start recording, Lauren said that she was going to be extremely professional when she started this conversation and asked me whether she was allowed to swear. And I was kind of like, you just do whatever you want. And we just got the first one in there. Then the way, you know,
so. What did I say? Go on.
No, it's all good. The point is, it's all good. So, you know, and you're getting a bit embarrassed now and blushing and whatnot, which is even funnier. But, you know, yeah, it's good to see a bit of the Mancunian come out there. And it was just passion. That was. But, I mean, you know, I am going to have to move it on because we also, when we were speaking offline, you know, yeah, I mean, it's fair to say, you're what I call a student of your game. You've sent me through a ton of notes, a ton of things that we were going to talk about, but it was based on one specific subject. And then within what I do with a lot of my clients, because this is how this conversation started, we do a lot of kind of goal setting and goal getting and all this kind of stuff. And most of the time things go well, but then occasionally they don't and whatnot like that. But there's something that's reoccurring a lot, and certainly reoccurring more and more frequently, is that when people start to do well, when they start to make changes, whether that's physical changes, you know, changes of mindset, appearance, career, whatever, this little sort of thing kicks in, and you know, the term is imposter syndrome, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what we want to ask you about specifically.
Yeah.
Today.
Okay.
So I'm going to hand that over to you now.
Okay. So imposter syndrome is when we believe that we are not capable of the things that we are engaging in, or sometimes other people will figure out that we're not capable of our own ability, really. And it's often grounded in a lack of confidence in a certain area, or more deep-rooted would be low self-esteem. The two things, confidence and low self-esteem, they're different, but most of the time they're not mutually exclusive. So they're tied in with each other. And so your self-esteem, your low self-esteem would be your view of yourself as a person and what you're about. And confidence is more about your belief in your abilities in doing certain things. That's what I would say. But they're very much intertwined, whatever the word is. They're very much linked. And imposter syndrome comes from that. So that when we go into a situation and we're doing something, we either doubt our own capability of doing it and doing what we're doing at that time and how well we're doing it, or it creeps in that other people might figure us out for what we really are, and that this isn't what we're meant to be doing and we don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you were on our last calls, actually, because that's almost
dying.
I can assure my clients as well that you absolutely weren't, and I can also assure them I haven't briefed you about our calls, you know, because obviously that's pretty much kind of word for word what has come out is that it was the two things. It was self-esteem and confidence. And it was one of the girls, she said, you know, her self-esteem was a view of herself. And like you said, the confidence was her ability to cope with a certain situation. What I've found as well is that when people start to do well, they resort to this innate, I am not good enough. I am not good enough, and I am not worthy.
I am not good enough is the main belief that I see the most frequently, and the belief that has the most intensity of all the beliefs that underpin low self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And if somebody reports not having any confidence, I'm not good enough, or thoughts of worthlessness. That's the big one, the main core belief.
Is there any other kind of words, expressions that people can look out for in terms of imposter syndrome, or any like red flags that identify that maybe it's something that's in there with themselves? You know, because you'll say to somebody about their goals, and sometimes the two words together, imposter syndrome, make people go, oh, that's not me, that's not me. I've found people can get quite defensive with it.
So I would say I'm not good enough is the big one. Mm-hmm. And I would say that when I'm working on low self-esteem, I would say that 90% of the time I'm not good enough comes up when we're identifying people's core beliefs. Another one might be I'm incapable.
Yeah.
I am incompetent. I'm useless.
Yeah.
People will say, I feel worthless, but that's a thought. So it would be thoughts of worthlessness. Yeah. But really, it can be anything that is an indicator that you have a core belief that, well, you're not good enough, or there's something negative about you. So, or there's something like, you know, we have core beliefs such as I'm unlovable. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So anything really can be an indicator of. I think imposter syndrome is quite an umbrella term that would cover lots of different anxieties, really.
Okay, so to sort of move that on and to maybe help the listeners a little bit to kind of, I think perhaps maybe link, because I've certainly suffered with imposter syndrome, and it's. It's something that's come and gone in many different occasions in my life, whether that's my career in particular, as a father, that's been one of the ones, you know, he's like, am I doing this right? Am I messing this up? You know, blah, 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 blah. And it's come and gone. And as I say, I've noticed with a lot of people that there's been that instant resistance. Like, no, that's not me.
Yeah.
I hate to generalize, but perhaps more the male.
Maybe.
But, you know, we talked about in terms of helping people link and identify, you know, that this might be something that they need to work on. You've put a sort of little case study together, haven't you?
I have, yeah. because I think it might be best to explain it using a case study and then talk you through how imposter syndrome, but I'm going to talk more about low self-esteem and confidence, because I feel that imposter syndrome is something that occurs as a result of there being difficulties with self-esteem and confidence. But I just wanted to sort of explain to you how it manifests. So how low self-esteem and confidence, how they happen, like why they can come about, and how we maintain them in ourselves day to day. So what we do or don't do that keeps us feeling that way. And then if we've got time, I'm going to talk about ways of breaking that cycle that we're maintaining ourselves.
So we talked about 60 minutes, didn't we?
Yeah, we talked about 60 minutes.
I'm not sure we're going to get there. I haven't actually got a timer on right now, but we will go through what we can.
Okay.
You don't want to know how long we've been on already.
Long have we been on already?
What I would say is we can always follow it up, can't we?
Yeah, of course we can. Of course we can. And I'll do like whistle stop of it all. And then if you want, what I can do is, if there's a certain bit that you want me to talk about more, mm-hmm. I could do like a full 40 minutes on that specific thing.
Okay, well, what I'll do is I put that out, because this is obviously is going out to my coaching group and all our guys, guys and girls, and we'll see what they come back with. Like you say, it's like a piece of cake in it, and the cake is absolutely huge, and we're going to try and skim over the top of it, but ultimately you could slice it up and you know,
definitely.
Probably not a great analogy that, but there.
Well, let's say that you're all going to get a look at the cake, and then if there's any bits that you think look particularly tasty, then you can ask Rick for another follow-up, and we'll focus on those specific bits.
So we've got Tom here, haven't we?
We've got Tom. Now, I just want to let you know beforehand that this is a very general example. So people might listen to this and think, that doesn't really resonate with me. I don't really relate to that. But just think of this as the process that I'm going through, rather than the content of it. Because if you were to do this for yourself, it would be so personalised. So just bear with me, because I've had to do a very general sort of one to just hit the markers. Yeah?
Yeah, cool. Go for it.
Okay, so I'm going to talk you through somebody that's might have come to me, or might have come to you as a pal, as a mate, and or in anything, any sort of setting really, and then talk about how we understand this and what's going on, and then what we might do. So I'm going to give you a bit of a background about a made-up person. I apologize if anybody listening is called Tom and thinks, sounds like she's talking about me. I'm definitely not.
This is not about anyone in the group or anything.
No, it's not. I don't know. I don't even know who's in the group. So, okay. So, I love the way I've tried to tie it in with you, but I clearly don't know. Not you being Tom, but like that Tom's going to like a sporting activity social group.
Yeah, I read this and I was like, is this me or not? No. It's 36, so that rules me out straight away, you know.
Okay, so imaginary person. So Tom is a 36-year-old male who has recently joined a new social group that includes attending sporting activities. Tom joined the group because he wants to extend his social circle and enjoyed various sports when he was younger, including being a keen runner and playing football. Tom attended several of the sessions, but has since gone missing in action, and the group leader has contacted him to see if everything's okay. Tom said that he's lacking in confidence and stated that whenever he engages in group activities or chats to other members of the group, he experiences imposter syndrome. Okay, so I'm going to give you a little bit of background about Tom so that you can understand the next bit that I'm going to talk you through. So Tom reports that he was raised in a loving household, but spoke about how his parents were high achievers who would place a lot of pressure on him to always be the best and do things perfectly. Tom stated that when he was in school, he struggled academically with some subjects and was sometimes teased. Tom stated that he had a few friends, but that most of his friends only became friends with him after he made it onto the school football team in his mid-20s. Tom had a girlfriend for 4 years who would make derogatory comments towards him and would tell him that he was useless. Tom recently had a job interview, and although he subjectively reported that it went okay and he received positive feedback, there were 18 other candidates and he didn't get the job. Okay, so we've got a bit of an idea about to what Tom's about. Yeah?
Yep.
Okay. So I think that if you watch this or listen to this and you think, do you know, maybe I do struggle with my confidence or my self-esteem, the most important thing to do, first of all, is to draw a bit of a map as to what's going on for you. Because if we can understand what's happening to us, then it's much easier to work on that. And I could give you tips and techniques to try, but if you don't know why I'm telling you to try them, you're not going to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we would do in therapy is we would draw what we call a formulation, but it's basically a map of what's happening. And this is the next thing that I sent to you, Rick. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what we would put at the top is, and if your listeners want to try this at home, they can follow what I'm saying. Okay. And I can also send links to things for them to see. Yeah, now,
I'm on the bottom. So
brilliant. Okay. So what we would first of all do is we would have a look at significant events in our past that may have impacted the way we see the world or ourselves. And this is where you're going to have to dig a little bit deep. You're going to have to go a little bit deep, because sometimes these can be things that are not obvious straight away until we think about them, that they've impacted us. So the first thing that we would put is significant events. And we would just jot down some of those events that we think have contributed to our change in the way that we think. So we've got here, if you can see at the top, we've got childhood, high achieving parents, lots of pressure to be the best or perfect. School, struggled with some academic studies, teased by peers. Most friendships made following getting on the football team. Mid-20s, girlfriend who made derogatory comments, such as you're useless, and recently didn't get the job.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just so you know, we absolutely cannot see that, by the way, but there we go.
Say that again.
You know, we absolutely cannot see those.
Oh, sorry. Right, okay. Well, I'll point, because it'll show you where it goes, but I'll talk you through it. So what happens is when we experience significant events, often these are events when we're a lot younger, but this can happen throughout our life. We develop beliefs about ourselves or about others or generally about the world around us.
Yeah.
So what I might say to someone is that, let's say, for example, that you have like a 19-year-old lad who has not really experienced any adverse life events, and he's walking on his way to Aldi to go and get some food. And his general core beliefs, because he's not experienced anything significant, might be the world is generally a good place, I'm generally safe, and other people are generally okay. Then he gets really horrifically attacked and ends up in hospital. And in that moment when that occurs, his brain will be trying so much to make sense of what's going on that he'll develop new beliefs about himself and the world around him, like the world is a dangerous place.
Yeah.
I'm vulnerable. Other people will harm me. So in Tom's case, we found that his core beliefs are, there you go, Rick, I'm not good enough. Okay.
Mine as well.
So I'm not good enough is a core belief that he has.
I'm not good enough.
Okay. Another one is I'm stupid. And I'm useless. And these may be beliefs that people have about themselves that underlie imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Now, these are core beliefs. So these aren't things that we think about regularly. They're not things that we consciously think about unless we try. These are deep-rooted beliefs that we hold, that we carry around with us. As a result of those core beliefs, we develop rules as to... rules that we come up with in our minds as to how we need to live life to get the best out of it and to stay safe. And that is because our brain recognizes that if I have a belief about myself, But I come up with a rule of a way to live in order to ensure that that belief either doesn't come true or isn't brought to the surface, then we'll do it. So, for example...
You're just trying to keep yourself safe all the time, aren't you?
That's it. Most of our behaviours come from fear. Most of our maladaptive behaviours. So our behaviours that are sort of to protect us, a lot of them come from fear. So Tom's core belief, I'm not good enough, I'm stupid, I'm useless. So he's come up with rules without realising it, such as I have to be or do the best at everything or others won't like and accept me. Okay. I should never make mistakes or this means I'm a failure. I should never try or do anything that I can't do perfectly, as if I can't do it, others will judge and I will be a failure.
Yeah.
So off the back of the way he sees himself, he's developed rules as to how he should behave.
Yeah, and I'm reading these again, by the way. I've read these already, but
yeah,
Ruin, he's talking to me. It's resonating with me, you know.
Definitely. So we'll all have them. So for somebody who's generally anxious, it might be, I have to keep my guard up all the time to stop bad things happening. You know, if they're worried about maybe being attacked or something like there being a gas explosion, they might feel like they have to be extra vigilant. But we all have rules. We all have core beliefs and we all have rules. Okay. Now, this is where the imposter syndrome comes to the surface. So Tom goes to group activities, social situations, new and unknown situations, or others making comments, all of these negative comments, all of these things trigger his anxiety to come about. So these situations occur and it causes him to have in the moment thoughts such as, I'm going to fail, I'm going to get something wrong, others will judge me. If I do something wrong, others will judge me. Now, when we have those thoughts, our fight or flight process kicks in. So we know that our fight or flight process is an evolutionary response to help protect us from predators and from threat. But the brain often can't distinguish between what is a real current threat and what is a perceived threat.
Yeah.
So when Tom has these worries that he's going to fail or others are going to judge him, his brain goes, ah, something bad's happening, something bad's going to happen. And his fight or flight process kicks in.
Sorry, how does his brain go again?
He goes, ah. That's exactly how it feels. And that's what your fight or flight would look like, I think, if it was in action.
That's the story of my life right there. So.
So his fight or flight will kick in when he has those thoughts, because his brain will be like, something's going wrong, I need to fight or I need to run away from this problem. And that's why you then get all the physical symptoms of anxiety, because actually that's just your adrenaline response kicking in. Your heart racing just wants to get more blood and oxygen pumped around so you can fight or run away better. Your breathing will change because your breathing wants to compensate for your changed heart rate. A really interesting one is that, you know, when you're nervous about something and you your stomach goes, you know, that horrible feeling.
Yeah.
That's because you'll probably know this anyway, Rick, but I love
all this. Right, all right.
That's because all of you, well, your oxygen in your blood is being sent to your arms and legs so you can fight or run away better. So as it moves away, your stomach tips over. So you're like, yeah. And also we often need to have a wee if we're a bit nervous, because we want to weigh less, don't we? So we can fight or run away. So
great, by the way, this is great. This is like being in school right now.
I have to say all of this though, so people really get it. So he has these thoughts, he has these worries that he's going to fail or he's going to embarrass himself and people are going to judge. And his fight or flight kicks in because it's like, I need to help myself through this situation. And if you mix those thoughts with those physical feelings and you bring those together, that's your emotional state. So that's when you feel nervous, anxious, or you might feel low if your body's gone the other way and you've tired yourself out or it's gone into void mode. So then you feel this emotion. Tom feels this emotion. So we've got this on here, as you can see. Tom feels this emotion. And then Tom
I'll show it. There it is.
Yeah. So then Tom feels this emotional state. And so then Tom engages in the red pill behaviours that we've got there.
Yeah.
So Tom says, not going to any group or social activities. I'm not gonna do anything that I think I'm gonna embarrass myself at, or I'm gonna fail at. I'm gonna try to do everything perfectly. I'm gonna over-prepare for things. Now, those behaviors in the short term, Tom's not gonna feel that anxiety or that imposter syndrome because he's not going into those situations, he's not facing those things. So he gets short-term relief. But in the long run, what Tom doesn't get to see is that even if he went ahead and engaged in those behaviours, even if he went ahead and engaged in those situations, the worst case scenario is a lot less likely than he thinks. And there's a much higher chance that he's going to cope more than he thinks. And so because he doesn't get to see what happens in those situations, whether he does get judged or not, whether he does fail, he keeps himself trapped in that worry that he's going to because he's not showing himself otherwise.
Yeah.
Which means that he continues to worry and have these negative thoughts because he's not disproving those. So if he continues to have those thoughts, he's going to continue to have his fight or flight kick in. Yeah. He's going to continue to feel anxious and be in a state of imposter syndrome. And then he's going to continue to engage in the red pill behaviours because they give him relief.
So it's just like a loop, isn't it?
That is exactly what it is. And you know, when we talk about a vicious cycle, like you've got yourself into a right vicious cycle, that's based on the cognitive behavioural therapy cycle. So I'm not very good at this. You're going to have to put yours up, Rick. Go on. So the bottom bit you can see is a cycle. So we go into a situation that triggers us. It leads us to have worries and thoughts. Then our fight or flight response kicks into our physical symptoms. And then we get an emotion and we do whatever we can to get rid of it. What we do to get rid of it only gets rid of it in the short term until next time. So we get trapped. And that is the cycle of low self-esteem, the cycle of low confidence, or that is the cycle of imposter syndrome.
Yeah, just so you know, Lauren, your camera's frozen there. I don't know if you just want to...
Yours did as well.
Ah, there we go. There you go, you back.
Okay.
So, I mean, that is brilliant and it makes absolute sense. I suppose the next question for me is, and I know we are skimming this, we are, because, you know, like you say, you can talk for hours on this.
Yeah.
That in itself, that loop and recognising, within my coaching programs, we call it self-mastery. We talk about the way you speak to yourself and so forth like that. And the labels you give something, you know, I'm scared, or you could say I'm ready. But the physiology is exactly the same, isn't it?
Yeah,
both, exactly. You know, heart rate, sweaty palms, or all that kind of stuff. It's just the label you're choosing.
Yeah.
So I suppose recognising the labels maybe is something, but is there any sort of top tips of recognising it, but also what you can then do about it?
Yeah, so I would say that recognizing imposter syndrome or recognizing low self-esteem or confidence, the easiest way to recognize it is that you avoid certain situations because of fear of what the outcome of that situation would be.
So avoidance and being scared.
Avoidance and being scared or escaping situations or... The opposite end of the continuum, doing more of things that you think will help you through that situation that we would call a safety behavior. So if you, let's say you feel imposter syndrome at work about something, you might stay in work 2 hours late every night. You might be reading all night when you get home. So you're actually engaging in like a safety behavior because you think you need to do that in order to be okay.
So you're overcompensating, basically.
Yeah. So the overcompensating actually is a red pill because you're not getting to see that you could face that situation and the worst case scenario is unlikely anyway.
See, that's mad you say that because I've always naturally been a bit of a worrier and a bit of an overthinker and so forth. And And my dad's always said to me, you know, you're worrying about things that you don't even know what will happen.
Yeah, yeah. And that, do you know what that comes from? That comes from, as human beings, we generally struggle to tolerate uncertainty, because in that gap of uncertainty, lots of bad things we think can happen. So we generally try to create a lot of certainty in our lives. And somebody who's a worrier will worry for that reason. They'll think that worrying is helpful because it bridges that gap of uncertainty. But actually, putting yourself out there and allowing yourself to sit with that uncertainty and not trying to control situations by overly preparing or overly worrying, and going into that situation and seeing what the outcome is, will cause better results in the long run, really, because you get to see what happens.
I mean, I was going to, and you've already answered it. I mean, I feel like I'm getting a therapy session here. It's great. You know, I mean, I feel like, literally, there's so many things for me, you know, personally. And I've always been very open with my clients about my ups and downs and highs and lows, because I think when you portray yourself as a superhuman, I don't think you can build rapport with your clients. Maybe
definitely. So I completely agree.
I've always been open about my struggles and vulnerabilities and all that kind of stuff. What I was going to ask was like for a sort of, and I think you kind of answered it there, but I'll ask you again anyway. It's just for a couple of tips. So you know that you've got imposter syndrome because you know you're there. Because I could talk to you about this all day, by the way, but I have to bring it to a close.
Yeah.
Just a couple of tips, really, you know, in terms of what would be your top two things, you know?
Oh, I'm not giving you two. Let me give you a few more. Can't give you two, Rick. Right. So the trick is that cycle, the trick is that we break it. Because if you remove one area of that cycle that we've drawn, the cycle can't feed into itself anymore and it breaks. Okay. So there's different ways to target that cycle. The first thing that I would do is identify what the thoughts are that are underlying your imposter syndrome. What are those thoughts of low self-esteem and confidence? And what I would do with that is something that we call evidence for and against, which is where you take the thought and you look at facts that support that thought is true and facts that support that thought is not true. Okay, so like Tom might say, well, this happened and that would tell me that I'm not good enough. But then he has to look at evidence and experiences that he's had that would contradict that thought and spend time doing it. So here would be an example, if you can see that. So look at evidence for and evidence against. I've not sent you that one. No, not sent you that one. So
I muted myself there. I was going to say, I don't think I got that one.
So we call this cognitive restructuring the way that we think. And it's taking a thought and it's basically chipping away at it and arguing it out on paper to start getting your brain to challenge negative thoughts. The other thing that I would say is a good thing to do is something that we call a behavioral experiment, which is where you test out the validity of your thoughts by doing something. So for example, and I've created one to give you an example for Tom. Okay, so let me tell you. So if his prediction is that he's not good enough and I have to be or do the best or others won't like me and accept me. So we think of something that would test that thought out. So it might be, I will try something that I know I'm not the best at, such as go for a hike with the new group that I'm part of. And I will test out if my belief is accurate, because if my belief is accurate, everyone in the group will huff at me. Nobody will talk to me after I've been, and somebody will make a snidey comment about the fact that I walk really slow. Go and put yourself in that position and see whether your thought is accurate or not.
Can I just say as well, Lauren, that is crucial. Because we've actually had this within our group. We go on walks and so forth, and we've had someone who didn't come to the walks based on a set of beliefs this person had created that somebody else was going to say to them.
Okay. So this happens a lot. We preempt a situation and we make a prediction, and then we don't engage with that situation because of our fear of what will happen. Now, we need to test those beliefs out. if we sit at home and we don't attend, we don't get to see if our belief is accurate. So we sit at home thinking our belief is accurate because we've not had evidence to suggest otherwise. If Tom was to go to that walk and nobody was to huff and puff or make a comment about how slow he walked people were still to talk to him afterwards, it would prove to him that his prediction and his belief was not accurate. So it's always important that we put ourselves in positions that we maybe feel a little bit uncomfortable in, mm-hmm. to test out the way that we're thinking and whether it's accurate or not.
Yeah, yeah. It makes absolute sense.
And the other thing is...
I won't tag the person, but I will. I will. Sorry.
Go on.
Get the person to listen to this.
Yeah, yeah. It's really important. So I'm going to ask you something now, Rick. Right? You have to be honest.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Okay. So I sent you some notes over, didn't I?
Yes.
I sent you something. Okay. Right. Okay. So you see the one that's not got the cycle on?
Yeah.
Okay. What came to mind when you read it?
There was elements of it that I've been in those situations myself.
Okay.
There was elements of it that I thought of other people straight away who I work with.
Okay. So it was relatable.
It was real life. Yeah, definitely. Okay.
Let me ask you something. Was there ever an opinion of me taken from what I sent you there? Anything cross your mind?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, and this is, you know, I said this before we started recording, I think it was a professional opinion, and the professional opinion was this is somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Oh, right. Let me stop you there. So you see at the bottom where, you see... two-thirds of the way down where I've wrote perfectly, but I've wrote it wrong and I've had to edit it. And you see near the bottom where I scribbled it out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what thoughts did you have when you saw that I'd...
Didn't resonate.
Okay. So I've got something to tell you. I've carried out a behavioural experiment with you tonight. So this is how this works in real life. No. So it's you know what? Let me tell you what I did. So this is why behavioral experiments are so good, okay? Because they give us evidence of new ways of seeing things. So I'll be honest, I was a little bit nervous. Don't really get that nervous about doing this. And I think because we've been focusing on imposter syndrome, my brain was hitting that angle. And I thought, oh, what if I'm incapable and crap at my job? And I thought, if I don't do something perfectly, others will judge me negatively and think I'm stupid and incapable. Incapable. Okay.
So
I set up an experiment. So my experiment to test my belief, I will make a mistake or imperfection on the information I give to Rick. How would I know if my belief or prediction was accurate? Rick will comment negatively on my mistake/imperfection. He will ask me to rewrite it without the mistake. When I ask him what went through his mind when he saw the scribbled part, he will say something that may indicate he thinks that I'm stupid or slightly incapable of doing my job properly. So you didn't. So if I was to look at that situation, I'd say, so the outcome was that Rick actually said he thought, I knew my stuff. He actually wasn't asked by the scribble. Like you were just like, didn't think anything of it. Rick just really didn't care about that scribbled out part. So the learning that I made from that is that my belief that I need to do things perfectly in order to be viewed positively, and my belief that I am incapable, it showed itself to not be true in this situation. So whereas I might have believed that 15% out of 100 before our conversation, you've actually given me evidence to support that thought is not accurate. So I believe that less. And this is why behavioral experiments are so effective, because we can challenge our thoughts by writing them down, but the evidence suggests that the most learning that we get is from things happening and from behaviours and things occurring. And so the more I test out my beliefs like this, the more my brain is changing. So if I was to carry out an experiment 3 times a week, they say that the plasticity in your brain changes if you do something 3 times. So it would start to change that belief I have about myself. So this is why it's really important that if you have a fear or a worry or an anxious thought or a negative thought in a certain situation, do something in order to test that thought out to see if it's accurate. Because if you can get rid of that underlying or minimize that underlying thought of, you know, people are going to figure me out because I don't know what I'm doing, or I'm a failure, or I'm not worthy. If you can chip away at that, then you're chipping away at that imposter syndrome. Then you're more likely to go into situations that are anxiety provoking. And then the more situations you go into, the more you're going to learn that your worst fear is not accurate. So you break that cycle there.
Yeah, love that. Sneaky bastard.
Hey, got you.
I'm doing an analysis tonight, but Lauren, we've got to leave it.
No, that's fine.
I love that, by the way, and I love the ending. That was amazing. I'm so glad I didn't rip into you over the
imagine. No,
there it was, wasn't it? Just a little bit of scribble there. I absolutely love that, and I love that the advice about breaking the cycle, and I think that's golden. I think that is, I mean, you've given about 50 different...
Oh, I could give you more. If you wanted another one, I could go into them in depth, and there's loads of other interventions. So I've got 5 written down that I could discuss with you, and I've discussed 2 of them slightly. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted another follow-up, and I could go through them in more detail and go through each of the different interventions that we can use. Yeah, I'll be happy to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to. I'm going to put it out to the group, but also I have another group as well. Obviously, I'm aware I'm still recording right now, so maybe it's something we'll talk about offline.
Yeah, but, of course.
Yeah, I love that. You never told me that you were you know, casting.
Well, it wouldn't work, would it, if I told you? Because you know... But it's just an example of it in real life, example of the sort of things that
all kinds of stuff there about my control freak needs and all that kind of stuff.
Some perfectionism going on.
Absolutely, absolutely leave that there. But, you know, for me personally, I want to massively thank you for your time. As I say, I'd love to hear more. I'm definitely going to follow this up with you as well, by the way.
You can do.
Old saying, Lauren, be careful what you wish for. You know?
Oh, no. Honestly, if it can help people, if it can help even just one person, then that's good for me.
There's been key bits there that we've got about 75 people in our group now, and our group's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. There's key bits there that are so relevant to some of our guys. And, you know, I'm sure we'd love to follow that on.
So
I'm going to stop recording. You stay on the line because I want to have a quick chat with you.
Okay.
But again, thank you so much for your time. And,
thank you for your time.
Cheers.